Let me start by saying to you that it is a real pleasure for Shaarei Zion to have been involved with Bina Institute over the last 4 years. It's a partnership where we, Baruch Hashem, are able to provide this facility for ongoing courses and lectures throughout the year and special events such as these. I'm sure all of you are very familiar with Bina's wonderful work in our community. Bina has been in existence here for 4 years, Baruch Hashem, provides a various number of ongoing courses, which are accredited by many universities, timely lectures. Rabbi Breidowitz, who of course needs no introduction, is an ongoing speaker for this wonderful institution. Rebbetzin Dr. Schlanger, how she's professionally known, it was her brainstorm, Bina, and she had, of course, support from the community, from our shul, from all of the Rabbonim here in town, endorse very strongly this institution. So we're happy to be a part of it. Rabbi Breidowitz says he will speak on Inyanei D'Yoyma. And my son asked me this afternoon, he was getting into pajamas, and he said, no shower tonight. I said, you know, he's a seven-year-old. Tell him, you know, it's the 9 days. And he says, yeah, I know. Is it really a sad time? Is it really a sad time? So the children pick up, and they realize the difficulties that we have in feeling the sorrow, the pain, and even the hope, which should be a product of that sorrow and pain. That's what it should bring us to. It's well known that Tisha B'Av is Kara Alai Moed, is considered a holiday, and we're not talking about in the future, but it's a holiday, it's a Moed, it's a time of Simcha to a certain degree in the present day. How is that? Because it's through the mourning and the sorrow and realizing what we can have that we begin to see hope and see a way and an avenue of making it happen. I don't want to take away from Rabbi Breidowitz's time. Also, I'm in the middle of giving the daf across the hall. Let me just end with this one thought. The Svasemes, and I've said this already over the past few weeks many times, the Sfas Emes says the following. He says, Chazal tell us that any generation that the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt in its times, it is as if it was destroyed. That's the Chazal. Kol Dor, every generation that the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt in, it's as if it was destroyed. Well, literally, that means that every generation up until now that didn't see Binyan Beis HaMikdash, didn't see the coming of Mashiach, they destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. That's why Sama says he can't live with that. He says, are you going to tell me that great generations, Ga'onim, Amirayim, Rishonim, Achrayim, the great generations that we have gone through over the past 2,000 years, greater than we are, they destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, and if, as we hope, Mashiach will come in our times, we rebuilt it. We're greater than they were. Ha! Look at that. They weren't able to, and they destroyed it, and we rebuilt it. Because how could that be? She says the answer is very simple. When Mitzvah Hashem, God willing, the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt, it will be a collective effort. It's not going to be one generation, our generation, that's going to come along and say, we rebuilt it. But it's collective over the generations. Every dar, every generation puts another brick into the Binyan Beis HaMikdash. No one generation can do it on its own. And what the Chazal mean to say, that any generation that the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt in its times, means that any generation that doesn't have a brick in the Binyan Beis HaMikdash, that doesn't have some sort of a part in the Binyan Beis HaMikdash. So they, as if it's as if they destroyed it. They didn't contribute to the Binyan Beis HaMikdash. That's why we always talk about Boinei Yerushalayim. the rebuilding, it's in the present tense. It's being rebuilt right now. When we come together, we are, in effect, rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. That's for each generation, and of course, for each and every individual. So when you look at the task ahead of you, we look at the task ahead of us of rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash, you're frightened. You're frightened. How? What am I going to do? I'm going to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. I'm going to say a kind word. I'm going to do a good deed. I'm going to be a better person. That's going to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. And the answer is yes, because it's a collective effort. Each and every one of us has the ability to put our mark and our brick in that binyan. And I'm sure Rabbi Breidowitz will tell you how. I can tell you maybe what to do. Rabbi Breidowitz is an expert in telling you how to do it. So enjoy.
Thank you. I want to thank the Mara Diasra and also Brishus, Rabbi Weiss, and Rabbi Shapiro. The Mesil Shishorim writes in the Hakdama that, of course, in his case, it really isn't true, that much of what he writes, he claims, is to be Devarim Yaduim, to be obvious words, words which are not Chidushim, but words because they are so obvious and so common, we often forget. That Mistama was not true about the Ramchal, whose work is full of Chidushim, but it'll probably be largely true of what I say tonight. And certainly, when we think about Tisha B'Av, we think about what Tisha B'Av means, what the Churban Beis HaMikdash means. What we need to hear and think about are not so much Chidushim, not lofty thoughts, not new thoughts, not original thoughts, but rather to simply internalize and reaffirm the fundamental ideas that all of us have absorbed, all of us learned, but it's so very hard to carry out in our daily life. You know, if you look at the pattern of the Jewish calendar, let's say starting from Pesach, which is the first of the Yomim Tovim, we see generally an upward pattern. We have Pesach, Zman Cheruseinu, and then we come to Shavuos, which is Matan Torah, then we have Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, days of Tshuva, days of closeness to Hashem, Sukkos, which culminates in joy, Zman Simchaseinu. So if you were to draw a graph, you kind of see an upward line going from Pesach, where we get the freedom from Mitzrayim, all the way to the joy of Sukkos. But in plotting that graph, the graph seems to have a downward turn in the middle of the summer when we have the 3 weeks and the 9 days and the Churban Beis HaMikdash, where it starts at Pesach, it dips very deeply down after Shavuos, then it goes up again. And the question is, therefore, in terms of the general understanding of the Mahalach of the year and how we develop our closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how do we understand this downward dip as part of the Avodas Hashem that culminates in the Tshuva of Yom Kippur, the Mechila, and also the Simcha of Sukkos? And to understand this, I just want to share with you another observation. Rav Soloveitchik, Alav HaShalom, made it, and other Gedolim have made it as well, where he points out that all of the halachas of Tisha B'Av are based on the halachas of Avelis, the dins of the laws of mourning, right? We don't, we sit in a low chair, etc. It's like we're sitting Shiva. And yet, the Avelis that is enacted to commemorate the Churban Beis HaMikdash follows the opposite pattern of the Avelis that applies in Chas V'Shalom private Avelis. In private Avelis, the Avelis starts off very severe, and it progressively relaxes as time goes by. We have a Shiva, where a person doesn't even leave a home, a person sits on a low table, etc., low chair. Then Shloshim, it's a bit more relaxed. And for other relatives besides father and mother, after Shloshim, there's no Avelis at all. For father and mother, it goes Yud Beis Chodesh, etc. So the Avelis restrictions begin at a very, very severe way, and then they progressively relax as time goes by. When we talk about the Avelis, which Chazal were misaken to commemorate the Churban Beis HaMikdash, we find the opposite pattern. We start off with the 3 weeks, and the truth is, in the Gemara, there's not even that much of a makor to impose various restrictions on the 3 weeks. So the way our custom develops during the 3 weeks, we don't have haircuts, etc. We don't make weddings. But then we come to Rosh Chodesh Av, which is stricter. And then we have, starting today, the week in which Tisha B'Av falls in, which is even stricter than the 9 days, then Erev Tisha B'Av, then Tisha B'Av. So if Avelis of a Yachid, if Avelis for the private person, goes min ha-chomor el ha-kal, from that which is more strict to that which is progressively more lenient, the Avelis of the Churban Beis HaMikdash goes min ha-kal el ha-chomor, it gradually builds up. And Rav Shaber used to say that this is because the psychological function of the morning rituals are very distinct. They move in opposite directions. When Chas V'Shalom a person loses a parent or loses a child or loses a sibling, their world is shattered. They are so immobilized, paralyzed with grief, that they often feel there is no way their life can go on. And yet, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is geyser, that each of us has to know that life must go on, that eventually we grieve and we mourn and we feel pain in our hearts, but eventually it is the Ratzon Hashem that we once again rejoin our fellow human beings, our fellow Jews, and rebuild. And thus, during the Shiva, when the person feels the pain the greatest, people come to him. The mourner is not yet ready to leave his home. During Shloshim, he leaves his home, but doesn't yet shave or wear clean clothes. And gradually, over Yud Beis Chodesh, the person rejoins society, but doesn't participate in festive events. And at the end of the year, the pain is still there, but the person has healed, we hope, so they will be able to join. When we come to the Churban Beis HaMikdash, we deal with the opposite problem. And that is, how many of us, our lives are shattered because of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? How many of us feel, my life cannot go on because we're in Golus, because the Shechina is in Golus, because there's no Yerushalayim HaBenuya, there's no Mashiach yet? It's exactly the opposite. For most of us, the problem in Avelus over the Churban is not that we feel so deeply that we can't go on, but that we don't feel anything at all. And therefore, Fakert, the purpose of the Avelus is not to escape the grief and become stronger, but to gradually acculturate ourselves in the course of these weeks, so we get into the mood and into the spirit and into the understanding of what it means to be in Golus and Churban. And that is why it's an opposite. If the end point of Avelus of a Yachid is to be able to leave the grief and rejoin society, the end point of the Avelus over the Churban is to recognize that there is a Churban. And that's why it moves in exactly the opposite direction. And Chazal talked about this. Chazal say in Maseches Shabbos that one of the questions each of us are going to be asked after we die is Sipiso li Yeshua. Did you eagerly await redemption? Not did you believe in Mashiach in an abstract way? Did you hope? Did we yearn? Did we feel there was something that was lacking in our lives? You know, they tell a story, and it's an apocryphal story, but as is true for apocryphal stories, there's always a kernel of truth about the fellow who was planning a long-awaited vacation to Miami Beach. And Mashiach came the day before his departure. And he was a little bit annoyed because he said, you know, Mashiach, you know, kept us waiting for thousands of years. Two more weeks, would that be so gefällig, you know? And yet, we say in Shemona Esrei, Kili Shuascha Kivinu Kol Hayom. We hope, we yearn, we wait every single day, every single minute. See, peace of Yeshua. It's very, very hard, and I know that, I'm sure that many rabbis have talked about it during this season of the year, to understand what even see peace of Yeshua means, particularly when, Baruch Hashem, we live in a government, we live in a society for which we have to be grateful, a Malchus Shel Chesed, a benevolent government which has given Jews many, many rights, particularly when we live in Baltimore, the Ir V'Yem B'Yisrael, what was called even 50 years ago, Yerushalayim D'America, and it's probably more true now than perhaps it was even true then, in which, Baruch Hashem, we have yeshivas, we have chinuch, we have Torah, we have restaurants and bakeries and all sorts of amenities and even luxuries which facilitate living a religious life, at least in terms of some of the externals. One could actually argue it hurts living a religious life, but that's a separate shmooze. And the question then becomes, what is it that we're missing, and how do we understand that there is a chisaron in our lives? It's been well said, a Hasidic Rebbe once remarked, that it's easier to be from in Siberia than in suburbia. And the remark was that sometimes in deprivation and in tsaros, you don't forget that you're Jewish, and you know what Mashiach is. You know there's something missing. In Baltimore, in the Jewish communities in America, it's a little bit harder to know that it is that we are missing. And thus, the Aveda of the 3 weeks, which intensifies after Rosh Chodesh Av, which intensifies with the Shavua Shechal by Tisha B'Av, is simply to generate within ourselves a sense of loss, a sense of chisaron. And in that way, as the Rav Soloveitchik points out, it is moving in the opposite direction of what it is that private mourning normally does. Okay. All right. Just to give you one little example, and again, I'll talk about this throughout my talk as to what it is that we're missing. Let me just point out, you know, we know that the first Beis HaMikdash was Necharav because of three big chatoyim, Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim, idolatry and sexual promiscuity and murder. And we also know that how come, you know, we talk about Avodah Zarah, we read about Avodah Zarah, and we ask ourselves, you know, what's this big thing about Avodah Zarah? And we know that the Gemara in Yuma tells us that at the time of the Binyan Bayis Sheni, the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, the men of the Great Assembly, actually prayed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu take away the Yetzer Hara of idolatry. It was such an overpowering Yetzer Hara that resulted in the Churban Beis HaMikdash. In fact, when the Gemara was discussing, certain kings don't have a chelik in Olam Haba, so they mentioned King Menashe, who was an Oved Avodah Zarah, and he was also a Machdi Asarabim. So they said, Menashe has no chelik in Olam Haba, because he was such a Rasha. So that night, Menashe came to them in a Chalaim, and Menashe was able to answer all of the kashas on Torah that they had. So they saw Menashe was a phenomenal Talmud Chacham. So they asked Menashe, you're so great, how is it that you could fall prey to the foolishness of Avodah Zarah? And Menashe told them, if you would have been around in my time, when there was a Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah, you would have cut your legs running through thorns to get to the nearest idol. We don't even understand what the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah is. How powerful it was could be seen by the fact that normally the one thing HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not interfere with is free will. And yet, this was an extraordinary intervention to take away the Yetzer Hara, to take away the Bechira that we will struggle with, so that we shouldn't be Nichshal in the Chet of Avodah Zarah. But there's a Vort B'Shem the Vilna Gaon that says that since there is never a vacuum, when the Yetzer Hara towards idolatry was removed from us, it was replaced by the Yetzer Hara for materialism and money. So if we want to know what the kayach of Avodah Zarah was like, let us look at our society, let us look at ourselves, and see what our striving for material comfort and pleasure is. Now, there is a very profound thought behind the words of the Gra, something to think about. The Gra is not Stam telling us, Avodah Zarah was taken away, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the Yetzer for money instead, so we struggle. Rather, the Vilna Gaon is indicating that a spiritual transformation of great magnitude occurred when the Yetzer Hara, the Avodah Zarah, was taken away. You know, in the olden days, in the 1950s, occasionally when people had mental illness, there would be procedures like lobotomies, which are not basically performed today, in which part of the brain would simply be cut away because it led to epileptic seizures or it led to violent episodes, and the way you control it is simply by excising it as a cancer, which may have cured the particular problem, but also often had drastic consequences. A person would undergo very severe personality transformations. Often creativity would be lost and the like. Today they have electroshock therapy, which sometimes has the same consequence, although it's not as drastic as lobotomy. I would suggest that the removal of the Yitzra di Avodah Zarah, because Avodah Zarah was so pernicious, so dangerous, so destructive, was in effect a spiritual lobotomy that the Jewish people underwent. Because as the Rambam tells us in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, why did Jews turn to Avodah Zarah? Because they had such a reverence for Hashem, they had such a sense of God's grandeur, God's glory, that they felt it was a chutzpah to turn directly to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore they turned, just as you don't go to the king, you go to the secretaries, you go to the cabinet officers. They felt that because of their great sense of kavod for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they turned to the Mesharsim, they turned to the servants, and it got distorted. Moreover, the Rambam goes on and says, it was their passion for closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that led them to find a material substitute to which they could relate. In fact, the great attraction, lahavdil, to Christianity is the humanization of a God, which is something that a human being can relate to, right? That's why it's Meshech people, because they make God in their own image. The pshat is, when the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah was removed, the reason we don't have the Yetzer Hara for idolatry is because we also lost a certain measure of the passion to connect ourselves to Hashem. It doesn't bother us as much. We don't need to make God in our image because we don't feel that cheshek, that desire, that hislavos, that burning passion that can lead a person astray. And it had to be taken away because it was dangerous. But we don't have it. It's taken away from us. And the funny thing is, the most difficult thing to mourn is that which you don't have. The blind person cannot mourn. The blind from birth person cannot mourn not seeing color because they've never seen it. The person who is born deaf cannot mourn not hearing music because they have no idea. As the Gemara says, Rabbi Eimer, quoting the verse in Eicha, Avoseinu amru nashinu taiva. Our forefathers could say, we have forgotten what goodness is like. We had it and we have forgotten. V'anachnu afilu b'yeinenu lo ra'inu. We cannot say we have forgotten what goodness was because we have never experienced it. So what do we mourn? We don't even know what it's like. And they talk a Torah story. Someone asks the Rav Bunim, the first Peshischa Rebbe, the Rebbe of the Gera Rebbe, that what does a person do when they can't cry over the Beis HaMikdash because the person doesn't know what it was? So the Gera Rebbe, so the Rav Bunim said, if a person cannot cry over the Churban Beis HaMikdash, let them cry over the Churban of their neshama that can't even feel that there's no Beis HaMikdash. That's the Churban. The Churban is in the neshama that lost the capacity to feel it. And that's the greatest Churban of all. I saw a modern version of the story that after 1967, when the Israeli army managed to recapture Yerushalayim and the Kotel, And obviously, in those first few months, thousands and thousands of Jews were going to pray at the Kotel for the first time in 19 years. And many from people were there, and they were crying, they were shedding tears, and they were sobbing because they were finally reunited with the last makam in which the Shechina is there, the Kaisel Maravi. And there was a young secular soldier who saw them, and he began crying as well. And one of his friends said, "What are you crying about? This doesn't mean anything to you." He's saying, "I'm crying because I have nothing to cry about. And that's what makes me cry. I look at them and they have what to cry about because they know what this represents. I'm crying because I don't even know what it is I'm supposed to be crying about." And in a way, even if, Baruch Hashem, we've managed in our own lives to live a life of Torah according to whatever madrega we have, but we're not as far from that young chayal as perhaps we think we are, that we too may have to shed tears over not even knowing what it is that we are supposed to cry about. And the Yitzhar Hara, the Avodah Zarah, is just one example of how what was once a passion for godliness and spirituality and intimacy has now become replaced and displaced on material things. And the MS is, if we could take the Vilna Gaon perhaps even a little bit deeper, the Vilna Gaon might mean, when he talked about the Yitzhar Hara for money, he might mean that even in our strivings for Avodah Hashem, the natiya tends to be expressed in the physical and material rather than in the internal and the spiritual. For example, a person gets up in the morning and a person says, "I want to do more mitzvahs. I want to do more things. I want to be better." How does that normally become manifest? It often becomes manifest by taking on a certain chumrah in halacha, which is, again, very good. I don't mean to demean that. But it tends to manifest itself in an extra external thing, as opposed to developing the resources of Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem and davening with more kavana, thinking about what we're doing, not doing more, but taking what we do and doing it on a deeper level. Because we avoid the internal. We avoid introspection. We avoid looking into ourselves because we are very afraid. Someone once remarked that perhaps the reason why society is so, or at least it used to be, so preoccupied with the exploration of outer space is because we are so afraid of inner space. We don't want to look inside because of the emptiness of the inside is much greater than the emptiness of the outside. We prefer to look at the outside and not in the inside. And the emes is, this explains the pattern of the calendar. I had mentioned before that we seem to be going up, Pesach, Shavuos, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and yet we have this downward glitch. The answer is no. And again, Rav Weiss actually said this thought just a moment ago. The answer is, it's precisely the awareness of the lack in our lives that is the first step towards being redeemed. Until we're makir honestly that our lives are not complete, until we're makir honestly that we live in a state of churban, of alienation, of isolation, of loneliness, until we're honest with ourselves that we have not achieved a geula, then how can we do tshuva? If life is perfect, what are we trying to change? And therefore, for Kert, it is precisely the stage of being makir that we are in gullus that brings a person to take those steps to rectify. Lamushal, if you're driving, you're trying to go north and you find yourself in 95 south, until you notice you're going the wrong way, there is no possible way of being changed. In fact, it's been well said, the deepest madrega of gullus is not yet knowing you're in gullus. Because if you're not yet knowing you're in gullus, there is no force within the person that is going to try to rectify that. So when does a person take the first step in getting out of being lost? When they recognize that they are lost. This is an old chiluk, you know, people talk about the difference between men and women. You know, one of the main differences between men and women, scientifically stated, is when do you stop and ask directions? Most men, if they're in a car, do not stop and ask directions until it's a totally hopeless situation. If we're 3 or 4 hours out of the way, we will finally concede. But the MS is that until one is makir that one is in the wrong way, there's no way. One is not made a tikkun. And therefore, for Kertz, it is the hakara of galus that is directly connected to tshuva and the Zman Simchaseinu of Pesach, of Sukkot. And that is why, as the Rav said, that is why, ironically, there is the glimmer of a joy on Tisha B'Av. An amazing thing. Tisha B'Av, the saddest day of the year. We don't say Tachanun. We don't say Tachanun, which is normally a prayer that you omit on happy days, Shabbos and Yom Tov, Rosh Chodesh, because it's as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us, whispering to us, that if you realize that you're in gullus, you have taken the first step to be reunited and close to me. And that is the meaning of Chazal, that Mashiach is nolad b'Tisha B'Av. Mashiach is born on Tisha B'Av. Again, the Mefarshim tell us that we don't necessarily have to understand the Agada as a literal statement. In other words, it doesn't have to mean that the birthday of the person who will be Mashiach will happen to be on Tisha B'Av. Again, we don't know exactly what that birthday is going to be, but it does mean that the seeds for Geula are implicit in the feeling of the depth of Galus that we have. That in that feeling, in effect, Mashiach is born. Mashiach comes out of that particular feeling. So this is just a general observation as to the Aveda of trying to be Margish the Golos, and of course the Achrayas, the responsibility that we have, is to rectify the Chatoyim that have caused the Churban. All of us know that the first Beis HaMikdash, as I mentioned, was destroyed because of the three most severe Averis, Aveda Zara, Gilei Arayas, Shvichas Damim. And the Gemara tells us in Yuma, again a very, very well-known Gemara, that the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed even though the Jews were by and large keeping mitzvahs because of sinas chinam, because of irrational, needless hatred, polarization, dissension that existed among Jews. And the Gemara in Yuma goes on and tells us, Bo Ure'e, that for the sins of Avodah Zarah, Gilei Arayas, Shvichas Damim, the Churban Beis HaMikdash was only 70 years. But for the Avera of Sinas Chinam, the Gemara wrote this, and this was already over 1,000 years ago, almost 2,000 years ago, Adayan, we are still in Gullus. That was then, and the truth is, it's today as well. And we see how severe this inyan of Sinas Chinam is. There is a thought that the Netziv writes in his Hakdama to Chumash Bereishis, where the Netziv tells us, what was the nature of the Sinas Chinam that existed during the second Beis HaMikdash? It was a Sinas Chinam that was based on a sense of religious superiority, where we looked at other people and we said, this person is a min, this person is a heretic, this person is an apikoris. We build ourselves up by looking down and being mevatel, the hashkafos of others, even if those others were within the general yud gimel ikarim of Torah, because it was not exactly the way we wanted to live our lives, not exactly the hashkafa that we have. And the Netziv says, the sinas chinam was the attitude, to put a modern paraphrase on it, that anyone to the right of me in religion is a fanatic, and anyone to the left of me is an apikoris. It is only where I am positioned that is the correct way, and those who are firmer than me are basically fanatical people. Those who are to the left of me are basically irresponsible, non-religious people. And in that sense, that was the Sinas Chinam. And the Netziv goes on and tells us that that Sinas Chinam is the hardest to uproot, because there's a certain element in which a person convinces themselves that this type of hatred and this type of righteous indignation is a mitzvah. It's l'shem shamayim. It's a good thing. It's a noble thing. You know, when we do things that are not good, and we know that they're not good, no, so we could be given mussar, we could try to work on them. It's very hard, of course. Rabbi Saul Solantra used to say that changing one bad midah is harder than learning all of Shas. No, that's very true. But at least we know it's something we have to work on. But when a person has a sense of being a tzaddik, because of that sense of being mevatel other people, that is a very, very pernicious and destructive midah that is almost impossible to eradicate. And the Netziv says, and in that sense, that's why it's different than avodah zarah, gila raya, shvichas damim, where people knew they were doing something wrong, but they couldn't control themselves, as opposed to sinas chinam, where there's not even a recognition there's anything wrong. You know, a few weeks ago, we read about the story of Pinchas, and of course Pinchas was the person who got up to be the zealot for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who saw Zimri ben Saloy, the Nasi of Shimon, and Cozbi bas Sur, the Midianite woman, and Klal Yisrael were dying by the thousands because of a magefa, and Pinchas got up and did what he had to do to save Klal Yisrael. We also know that when the Chumash describes Pinchas, the Chumash describes Pinchas as Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron, and Rashi already read raises the question, why does it give us his grandfather, Ben Aaron? And Rashi gives different answers, different Mefarshim give answers. But Rav Chaim Shmulevitz points out, a very beautiful thought, that the reason why it says, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron, you could translate it two ways. The simple meaning is, Pinchas, the son of Elazar, and Elazar was the son of Aaron. You could learn that way. Or the other way of translating it is the following. Pinchas was a son of Elazar, in terms of his genealogy, and Pinchas was a son of Aaron in terms of his personality. And Aaron was the Ohev Shalom, the lover of peace, Rodev Shalom, the pursuer of peace. Pinchas did not act out of anger. He did not act out of disparagement. He did not even act out of a desire to punish a wrongdoer. He acted out of love for Bnei Yisrael. He acted because he loved his people and needed to do what he had to do to save them. And what the Torah is made is, anyone who seeks to be the Kanoi must be motivated out of love and not of a desire to punish. If Pinchas would have acted, not because he was a Ben Aaron, of an Ohev Shalom v'Rodev Shalom, but Pinchas would have acted out of his anger, out of his animosity, out of his desire to expose shortcomings and show a Russia up, that would have been an act of Ritzicha, that would have been an act of murder, that would not have been an act of legitimate Kenas. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik used to say in this connection, that how do you know the difference between the true zealots and the false zealots? He compared it to a housewife who buys a cat because there are a lot of mice running around the home. The housewife and the cat do share a common agenda to a certain degree. They both hope that if there are mice, the cat will catch them. But what's the nafkamina? What's the difference between the housewife and the cats? So Rav Chaim says, the housewife would be much, much happier if there'd be no mice in the house at all. The cat hopes it can find a mouse so it could tear it apart, eat it, and expose it. Rav Chaim says, sometimes there's a kanois where we look and we pry and we try to see something wrong in this shita and that shita, that person, that book, because we get a tremendous ego satisfaction by exposing the shortcomings of others that makes us look like tzaddikim and build ourselves up by not raising ourselves, but simply lowering everybody else. That, of course, is the great Yetzer Hara of Lashon Hara generally, where we, as it were, we elevate ourselves without raising ourselves, but we just lower the floor around them. Right? If I'm standing on the floor, I can be higher either by raising myself or by lowering everybody else. It seems to be easier, for whatever reason, to lower everybody else and stay the same. So Rav Chaim says, the true Kanoi gets no joy in finding shortcomings of other people. The true Kanoi gets no pleasure in seeing averis that are done in the world. He or she sheds tears, cries, does what they could to recognize the good in others, does what they can to protest evil and averos and try to rectify. But their goal and their desire is that all should be mekabel the malchus of Hashem. And there's no joy in finding people who are not always living up to those standards. And the Gemara in Shabbos says on the pasuk, im yesh malach achad minei elef, that the midah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is that if a person has 999 angels in Shemayim that say this person is no good, and there's one angel out of 1,000 that says, you know, there's something good here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, that's enough for me. I look at the one out of 1,000. And then Rabbi Elazar goes on and says, and if even that one angel out of 1,000, 999 parts of that angel, don't see anything redeeming in the person, and one 1,000th of an angel out of 1,000 sees some tzadzichus, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Pidzo'eyu, let me redeem that person. Matsasi kaifer, I have found an atonement for that person. And how often in our own lives is it the opposite way? A person can have 999 good qualities, but the very first thing we focus on and that we notice, we point out to ourselves, not necessarily Lashon Hara, Baruch Hashem, I hope in recent years there's a great consciousness about not saying bad things about others. But how often in our minds, to give ourselves a sense of security. Again, it's sometimes a natural sense. You know, we're fragile. We sometimes feel beleaguered. We sometimes feel inadequate, rightly or wrongly so. And we see about accomplishments of other people or good things of other people. It's almost a psychological defense mechanism to punch some little hole in that air. 999 good midos. One bad thing, we see the bad. How often does that happen in our relationship with husbands and wives, where a spouse might do something good for another spouse, but something's a little bit off, and that's somehow the first thing that we notice? Our kids might be doing something which, again, a little bit off, and we notice the chisaron, and we don't notice all of the good, all of the effort that was put in. That also, again, if we're not going to call that sinas chinam, because obviously it doesn't culminate, hopefully, into hatred in that sense, but certainly it's related to learning to see the good, learning to appreciate, learning to focus. And that is why even some of the discussions of Lashon Hara sometimes miss the point in this sense. You know, we talk about the importance of controlling what we say. Very important. However, we have to recognize that ultimately it's a function of what we see and what we think. Because if we learn to habituate ourselves for hakaras hatov, to see the goodness, to see the milas, then we have less of a compulsion to speak badly about others, because we learn to see the good. And of course, and that includes, you know, the famous story of the Chafetz Chaim, when he was young, he was selling his svarim, and he was selling them anonymously, and a man once saw him selling the sefer and said, oh, this Chafetz Chaim must be such a great person. And the Chafetz Chaim said, yeah, I know the person, he's no one special. So the man went ahead and slapped the Chafetz Chaim in the face, and when they got to a town and he realized this was the Chafetz Chaim, he was so apologetic, he was mortified, and the Chafetz Chaim said, I learned an important lesson here, that I'm not supposed to say Lashon Hara even about myself. Right? The famous story. But of course, it also applies here as well, because the desire of cutting other people down is because we often don't have a sense of the goodness in our own Avodas Hashem, our own potential. So the way we achieve equilibrium and well-being is by saying, well, I'm rotten, but so is everybody else. Instead of cultivating the midah that people are capable of wonderful things, and I can admire them, I can emulate them, because I'm also capable of doing wonderful things as well. So it's a simultaneous process. Again, the Chafetz Chaim's insight is very profound, because it is often the saying of Lashon Hara on oneself, or the thinking of Lashon Hara on oneself, that results in a need to disparage others to achieve a sense of well-being. You know, we learn in Chazal, we learn in Yeshivas, you know, all these Gemaras that talk about Eglon Melech Moav, the father of Rus, who did one good thing in his life. He got up when Ehud ben Gera comes in and says, I have a message from Hashem. So Eglon, who was a heavy guy, I guess it was hard for him to get up, gets up and he takes 3 steps. And Chazal say, because of the Gimel Pesios, 3 steps he took in honor of Hashem, he is zochet to have a daughter, Rus HaMayaviyah, from whom, of course, comes David HaMelech, and ultimately Mashiach. And Chazal are full of statements. This person did one good thing in his life, and this person did one good thing in his life, and there's Gevaldik Yisachar. And we look at so many Jews, and we see the bad. And you know, you may ask, well, maybe this is fine if we talk about Jews who are Shomer Mitzvahs. But what about Jews who are not Shomer Mitzvahs? But the emes is that I remember teaching in Columbia a number of years ago, Columbia, Maryland, and we were talking about something, and somebody said in the course of the conversation, well, I'm not as religious as you, so I don't follow that because I'm not as religious as you. And my response was, how do you know that? Who says? I may keep Shabbos better than you. I know a little bit more about Hilchos Shabbos. Maybe you honor your parents better. Maybe you're a more considerate spouse. Maybe you're more careful in Lashon Hara. That is Avodas Hashem as well. And instead of dividing the world into an us versus a them, there has to be a recognition that even within the so-called them, the Jews who may not be fully observant of Torah, there is much goodness. There is good things, not to be mevatel, to see that people are struggling. There are people who are tinok shenishba, who are like children who were captured at a young age, who don't know. But there are many, many, many Jews who we would call conservative, reform, reconstructionist, unaffiliated, who are fundamentally good people who have a desire to grow in their Yiddishkeit, but don't always have the tools and don't always have the knowledge. And if we relate to them with a sense of disparagement, or a sense of apathy, or a sense of not caring, because remember, sinas chinam does not have to mean we hate them, but sinna can include ignoring them, not caring, not being concerned for them, then at worst we're creating a chilul Hashem, and at best we have failed to create the environments that will have them explore. And I want to emphasize too, and anyone that works in Kiruv or anyone that deals with Balei Tshuva knows this, and maybe it's an obvious point, that in dealing with a person who is not yet fully conversant with halacha and with Yiddishkeit, the issue is not simply they're an empty vessel that I'm there to fill up, and I am the person who has everything good, and they bring nothing to the table, and my job is to teach them the right way, because that's not going to work. Because that fundamentally is not premised on a sense of respect for that other person. But rather, one has to be machshiv, the goodness in them. One has to respect them. One has to see that they are bringing something worthy to their Yiddishkeit. And just as you are in a position to teach them things, they are in a position to teach us things as well. And if there is not that sense of respect and kavod for the goodness that they have because they are also B'Tselem Elokim, then one will never be able to attract people to the full life of the Torah. So all of that is nichlal in sinas chinam, and I would suggest again that the Nitziv's words of not labeling tzeduki v'apikoris do not only apply to the shomrei mitzvahs who are undoubtedly not in the category of tzeduki v'apikoris, but even to the Jews who are non-affiliated, non-observant, who in an earlier time may well have had certain labels attached to them, but in this day and age, by and large, cannot have those labels attached to them, simply because the environment, the seviva, the educational system has not given them the knowledge. And they tell a joke. it's a joke, but again, it's actually a true statement about a certain person who wanted to become an apikoris. He was a heretic. So he was told in Minsk, if you want to be an apikoris in Minsk, you have to go to Reb Yossele. He's the chief apikoris for the region. So the man goes to Reb Yossele. He sees an old man with a white beard who's sitting and learning Gemara, sitting in tefillin. So he says, are you Yossele? He says, yeah. He says, are you the apikoris? Yeah, I'm an apikoris. So he says to Yossele, well, I want to be an apikoris. What do I have to do? So Yossele looked at him and said, well, certainly you finished Bavli and Yerushalmi. He says, no, I haven't done that. He says, no, you know Tanakh? He says, no. He says, Chumash and Rashi? He says, not really. So Yossele said, you're no apikoris, you're just an amoritz. You're not a heretic. You're too ignorant to be a heretic. And the truth of the matter is, all of these labels, all of these negations, have no possible way of applying, at least to the average Jew out there, simply because, as the tragedy of the story indicates, people are too ignorant to meet the standard of a heretic. But I want to emphasize that in the Aveda of Sinas Chinam, the issue is not merely, I'm there to make their life better. The issue is recognize the goodness that is there. If we go back to Yetzias Mitzrayim, go back to the Jews in Mitzrayim, who were living on the 49th level of Tumah. If they would have hit level number 50, they would have been irredeemable. They were Ovdei the Avodah Zarah, they worshipped idols. They were Mefer Bris Mila. They were not practicing circumcision. They were not frum in any meaningful sense. And yet Chazal say that they were able to be redeemed. Gemara in Saita tells us because they didn't change their names, they kept Jewish names, they didn't change their language, they didn't change their clothing. Now how do we interpret that? It certainly was not out of religious motivations because they were idol worshippers. It was what we would call pejoratively ethnic identification. They identified themselves as Jews. We don't keep any mitzvahs, but we regard ourselves as part of the Jewish people. We rejoice in the joys of the Jewish people, and we feel the agony of the sufferings of the Jewish people. They are our brothers, they are our sisters. We cared for each other. That, of course, was not the end all of Klal Yisrael. Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim for a purpose. Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim for a purpose. Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim to give us the Torah, no question. Having that identity is not the end. There is much more that must follow. But if it's not the end, it is the beginning. It is the foundation. And when that is present, there is all sorts of potential for redemption that can come out. And Fakert, the Rambam tells us in Hilchos Tshuva, the Rambam describes a person who can keep all the mitzvahs of the Torah, all the mitzvahs. But he's what is called a poresh midarchei hatzibur. He separates himself from Klal Yisrael. What does that mean? The Rambam says, Eino sameach b'simchasam. He does not have any joy in their joys. He does not suffer when they suffer. The Rambam says, he doesn't care. He lives in his own Dalet Amos. or just his immediate friends. The Rambam says such a person may keep all of the mitzvahs of the Torah, but ein lo chelek li'olam haba. He has no chelek in olam haba. He's totally cut off. So again, the idea of sinas chinam, of seeing what it is in other people, seeing the good in other people, seeing their potential, seeing their courage. Often we don't appreciate this, but Chazal were sensitive to seeing even in Rishayim good things. And yet we, even in good people, only sometimes see bad things. We cut them off. This happens again very often with people are balei tshuva. This may translate into rejecting their family, cutting themselves off. Again, each case is a very individual case. But by and large, it's an approach that is not good. Because one's Yiddishkeit should be a source of Kiddush Hashem, of showing light, showing this is a good thing, and not something that creates walls and barriers and disparagement between people. So this is the idea of sinas chinam. You know, there's another maisa that comes to mind. There was a famous Jewish-German philosopher in the early part of the 20th century, Franz Rosenzweig. In fact, Martin Buber and Rosenzweig wrote a well-known German translation of the Torah, which is actually regarded in fairly high esteem. And Rosenzweig, towards the end of his life, became somewhat of a Baal Tshuva. He was stricken, I think, with multiple sclerosis. He was very, very ill. And towards the end of his life, he was turning more towards Yiddishkeit. And at one point in his life, he was asked if he puts on tefillin. And his response was, not yet. And it's been said very well that there's all the difference in the world between a not yet and a no. When a person says no, they close the door. They say, my life is a box. This is what I am. I'm going no further. When a person says not yet, a person is honestly making the declaration that I know that I'm on a journey, that the way to Hashem is not a single point. The way to Hashem is a ladder, like Yaakov Avinu's dream. Sulam magia hashamayma. The sulam is mutzav arza. The ladder is resting on earth. And it's ola l'shamayim. And our goal in life is to try to climb that ladder step by step by step. And the ikar that Hashem looks at is not where we are on the ladder, but in what direction we're going. That if we're going up on the ladder, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is an erech apayim, and will lead us gracefully, slowly, gently up that ladder. But if we stay still or try to climb down, then it makes no difference where we are at that point. At that point, we've committed a very, very grievous avera. And thus, the not yet is a common kesher that I can have with any Jew that is a searcher. Because everybody has a not yet. The Gadol Hador has a not yet because he hasn't yet mastered some Masechta in Yushalmi, maybe, or whatever it might be. And the average Jew has a million not yets. And the person who is a not yet Shabbos is also a not yet. But we can join hands and recognize that all of us have inyanim and avodas Hashem that we have to perfect, we have to grow. And the essence of avodas Hashem is in the striving, in the she'ifa, in trying to grow as a Jew and not staying in a rut. And with that type of mindset, we could indeed work very much on minimizing the sinas chinam that is between us. You know, in Eretz Yisrael, I knew a person. And again, Eretz Yisrael is, to some degree, a different environment than Chutz La'aretz, as all of us know. But I knew a person that sent his children to different yeshivas because they needed it. And the different yeshivas had different mandatory head coverings. So for one yeshiva, there was a black hat. Another yeshiva was a velvet yarmulke. A third yeshiva was a kippah seruga. And he kept a variety of head coverings in his car as he dropped off his kids every morning. And I was with him once. He was running very late. And one time, he just ran into the building with his four-year-old, and he had a kippah seruga on, and he should have had the other one, etc. And it took a great deal of explanation and, you know, accident. You know, basically, he got in a lot of trouble. And there was some discussion about maybe this is not the right school for your child, etc. And, you know, when we laugh about this and etc., but the truth is that it is symptomatic very often of how Klal Yisrael behaves. And if we look at the other segments, conservative, reform, rabbinate, which attacks orthodoxy very, very bitterly. And we say, look at them, look at what they're doing. We're no worse. But the answer is, it's no terrors to say we're no worse. A yid that holds on to the Torah of Hashem, and a yid who wants to make a Kiddush Hashem, who wants to teach the sweetness of Torah, the love of Torah, The fact that someone else is not yet living up to that standard is no message to us. Because, you know, I come from Washington. In Washington, it says today that the only qualification for public office is you've committed no indictable offense. If you haven't done anything for which you're indicted, you know, you can run for office. That's not a Jewish thing. In other words, that we're being attacked on a worse level and we're no worse than others, that is not a teretz. Because the Torah wants us to elevate ourselves. And this is the main avaida of the sinas shechina. Just want to mention again, as we go through all of this, the idea of sinas shechina, learning to see the good in others. Let me mention in particular, there's an application here for shalom bayis. And again, Baruch Hashem, if we have marriages, we hope that at least we don't have active sinas chinam. That would certainly not be the good basis for the marriage. But let me just share with you a short thought about marriage that we could think about during this period.
What
does the Torah say about marriage? Why did Hashem create Chava? So the Pasuk says, Lo Tov. It is not good for Adam to be alone. Esalo ezer kenegdo. Let me make a helpmate to be opposite him. The Torah, in the beginning of Evan Hoezer, asks a very simple question. Why is it not good for a man to be alone? When was this said? This was said in Gan Eden. In Gan Eden, Adam Harishon had whatever he wanted to have. The fruits were growing without work. There was no need for laundry. He didn't have to wear clothes at that point. What is so bad? Lo tov heyosa adam levado. So the Torah tells us a gevaldike insight into marriage. He says, Adam harishon as a levade, as a person alone, could take whatever he wanted to take from the world. But he had no one to whom to give, no one to whom to share. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is called the ultimate Tov. The meaning of Tov is to give. And Hashem is called HaTov V'HaMeitiv because the Eibishter does not take from it. Anything we give Hashem is already Hashem's. Why did Hashem create the world? So all the Sforim tell us. Hashem created the world because he wanted to bestow of his goodness to this world. In fact, the Ramchal goes on and develops the whole theory that the very reason why the world is such a difficult place is Hashem wanted to create an environment by which we would earn Hashem's goodness in Olam Haba, because otherwise we would be humiliated by getting something for nothing. So he creates the whole struggle so that the ultimate reward will not be Nahama de Kisufa, the bread of humiliation, but be something that we earned. And therefore all of the struggles of Olam Hazeh are part of the Chasdei Hashem, the loving kindness of Hashem. So that when we get the reward, it's something we really treasure, because we feel that we've earned it in a way. So Hashem is called a Tov because he's a giver. So the meaning of the verse, Lo Tov Heyos Adam Levado, means man cannot be a Tov. A human being cannot be a Tov if he's a taker. A human being can be godly only if we become givers rather than takers. And therefore HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Adam v'Chava, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the divine institution of marriage to enable each of us to spiritually perfect ourselves by learning to give to another human being instead of being a taker. It's an amazing thing. Marriage was not ordained to fulfill the individualistic needs of each party to the marriage. Marriage was created to give me the chance to learn to be a giver, to escape my egotism, my selfishness, and similarly for my spouse, and thereby become a holy person, a noble person. In the Chassidus Sforim, they say, this is the meaning of the verse, Al ken yazei vish es aviv yes imai. A person shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife. So people ask the kasha, you get married, you're still supposed to honor your parents. So the Sifrei Chassidus say, v'derech drush, that when a person is a child, they are there to take from their parents. Their parents are there to give. So, yazayv ish es aviv v'sima, when you get married, don't enter marriage like the child who is there to take, but enter marriage with the havana that the avoda is to give. Of course, again, there's a lot of subtleties in this. Part of learning to give is learning to take, because sometimes the greatest chesed we give another human being
is to let that other human being do something for us. Otherwise, they feel they're always on the receiving end, etc. So it's a very subtle idea that part of giving chesed is receiving. There is a concept of receiving chesed to build up the other person's self-esteem, the person's chashivas. But the Mefarshim say that this is the pshat that we say at a bris. Just as a child enters a bris, so may he enter Torah, getting married, masim tovim. So people ask the question, it's not in chronological sequence. Because Torah is when you're 3 years old. Child learns to talk, he should learn, say, words of Torah. Usually the first word tends to be pizza or something, but you know, we try to have the first word to be Torah. Now then masim tovim is l'chaira bar mitzvah or bas mitzvah. So why does it say chuppah afterwards? Why doesn't it say chuppah afterwards? So the Mefarshim say that it all depends how you define masim tovim. If masim tovim referred to mitzvos, the chiyuv of mitzvos, Itaka should have said masim tovim and then chuppah. But masim tovim alludes to the verse lo tov heyosa adam levado. And here, let me give you a quick example. There are many actions in a person's life that are neither mitzvos nor averos. We would call them morally neutral. If I go into a Giants or 7 Mile Market and I'm debating what to buy for breakfast, should I buy Cheerios or Rice Krispies? You know, I don't know if you would ask a Rav, but I would tend not to ask a Rav necessarily about which one I would buy, because basically the Rav would say, it's your choice. There's a certain level of autonomy, even within a strict halachic community, that the Torah gives us, right? We can choose as long as it's kosher. Now, so come to Chais, it's not a mitzvah, it's not an aveira. Now, let's say the day after Sheva Bracha, so the day after marriage, I go into the store for the first time, and I have to make a decision what breakfast cereal to buy. And my wife likes Cheerios and I like cornflakes. So now I have to make a cheshbon. I have to make a cheshbon. And if I decide to buy Cheerios because that's what my wife likes, or if in a Salmonic fashion I buy 2 boxes of cereal because I say, I like this, but I'll get for my wife. An amazing thing has happened. The decision that was made in the store has now become an act of kedusha. It's an act of godliness because you made your decision in reference to being a gomel chesed to someone else. If the characteristic of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is tova hametiv, every single action we do in our lives for purposes of hatova becomes an act of emulating v'halachta bidracha, the mitzvahs say in the Torah, to emulate the midos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That level of masim tovim, where every mundane decision you make, even as to how you're going to dress, because everything in a marriage very often will depend on some interaction with the other person, now becomes an act of kedusha. And that is why it says chuppah and then masim tovim, because that level of masim tovim, by and large, is going to be correlated to the level of chuppah. So again, as we approach the idea of learning to become Ovdei Hashem, well, let us remember that a part of the Aveda of a marriage is not so much what I get out of it, but it's precisely, or what I get out of it rather, is a function of my perfecting myself by learning to be a giver. And as we know, as the Chazon Ish points out in his Sefer Emunah U'Bitachon, the more a human being can escape their ego and their selfishness, their arrogance, the more we now become, now we learn to become connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well. That's why if you look at Shir HaShirim, you know, Shir HaShirim is a metaphor, right? Shir HaShirim is a mashal for the great love that Hashem has for the Jewish people. But it's written as the story of the love between a man and a woman. And that's why, Chas V'Shalom, it is often misunderstood, and it is portrayed as love poetry, romantic poetry, from a secular standpoint. And that's why if you look at the Art Scroll translation of Shir HaShirim, you will notice that they do not give you a literal translation, because they say this is too prone to being misunderstood, and therefore instead of talking about the man and the woman, we talk about Hashem and Bnei Yisrael, and instead of talking about any type of marital intimacy, it'll talk about the 10 Makos and Matan Torah, incorporating the allegorical interpretation of Rashi. And they said they did this on the advice of the permanent editorial board. Now, Shlomo HaMelech, who wrote Shir HaShirim, did not have the benefits of the Art Scroll permanent editorial board. And the question is, though, he did have another credential on his side, and that is he was called the Chacham Mikol Adam, the wisest of all human beings. So why did Shlomo HaMelech have to write a piece of Kisvei HaKodesh, Kodesh HaKadoshim, that is so prone to being misunderstood, that is so prone to looking at in a secular, prosaic, even Chas HaShalom, pornographic way? Why didn't he write it the way the Art Scroll translated it? And Rav Gifter once said, a beautiful thought, Rav Gifter pointed out, that Shir HaShirim is a mashal. In other words, it's a parable representing love of Hashem. But the way we learn to love Hashem is only to the degree that we can learn to love another human being intimately. That if we don't have the capacity to go beyond ourselves and connect to another, we cannot love Hashem as an abstraction. Because all human love, when it's ultimately love, is based on divine qualities in the other person. If you love another person because of their midos, because of their intelligence, because of their wits, because of their compassion, as opposed to physical things, those are parts of the Tzelem Elokim that is within the person. You're really loving the aspects of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that are incorporated in that person's neshama. And from that you come to love Hashem. Because you can't love Hashem and not love HaKadosh Baruch Hu's children. Just as when you love a human person, if you truly love a human being, even if you think they're kids or whatever it is, you will have to have some level of love for those children. And so Hashem says, you can't love me if you can't love another human being that is created in my image. And that is why Shir HaShirim is written in that particular way. Leo Tolstoy, the famous author of War and Peace, towards the end of his life was a very active social reformer, and he wrote a lot of books about abolition of smoking. This is in the 19th century, and Tsarist Russia had serfdom of slavery. And Count Tolstoy was once asked if he believed in the abolition of slavery, which he did, why was he so cruel to his own serfs? And Tolstoy reputedly remarked, "I am a lover of humanity. I don't get along with people very well, but I do love humanity in the abstract." The lesson of Shir HaShirim is fakert, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not interested in global abstractions. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not interested in loving the masses of humanity. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu was interested in the daily interactions, which are not very dramatic, but the daily plodding along of life, as Rav Weiss said, the concept of building the brick, building the edifice of the Beis HaMikdash, one little brick at a time. And that is what Shir HaShirim teaches us. You want to love Hashem? First learn to love your fellow human being. And then you will come to the highest level of Avas Hashem. There is another chazal as to why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. You know, we've been focusing very much on Sinas Chinam. The Gemara in Nedarim says, Al Shalo Berchu Batayra Techila. Now technically that is probably referring to the first Beis HaMikdash, although it's said to have applied to the second Beis HaMikdash as well, and that is that the generation was destroyed because they didn't recite the blessings before the Torah. And one wonders, all right, reciting the blessing before the Torah may be a mitzvah. The Ramban says it's a mitzvah d'oraisa, but why is that such a serious aveira? And there's a vort from Rav Yoel Lapian, which again is something that we have to think about. And he says that we find with David HaMelech, when David was old, he was very cold, and when he was covered with garments, they were not giving him any warmth. And Chazal say that is because years before, when Shaul was pursuing him, and one time Shaul was asleep, so if you remember, David cut a little bit of Shaul's cloak and then went up on the mountain and said to Shaul, "You see, I was so close to you, and I didn't kill you." So Chazal say, from here we learn out, Kol HaMevazeh HaBegadim. If one treats clothing with disrespect, the clothing are not, they're not going to give you comfort. So if people throw their clothing around, they should be aware that there's a condemnation here of mevazeh sabagadim. So Rav Yoel Lapian says that we learn from this an important idea, that if one does not show respect and regard for a certain thing, that thing will not fulfill its ultimate function. And he says, kal v'chomer, when it comes to Torah. People didn't recite a bracha on the Torah, the Ran says. They learned Torah, but the Torah was not important enough to them to require its own bracha. Right? They regarded Torah as a hechsher mitzvah, just like you don't make a bracha when you build a sukkah, because that's not the main thing. The main thing is the sitting in the sukkah. So too, they didn't make a bracha over the Torah, because they regarded learning Torah as just a way of getting practical knowledge, but not as something intrinsically important. And therefore, Leo Lapian says, when one is mevazeh es haTorah, The Torah does not protect you from the most serious averos. In fact, as he says, the pshat in the Gemara is this. It's not that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because there was no, they didn't say Birchas HaTorah, but rather the lack of Birchas HaTorah showed there were Mavazes HaTorah, and therefore they were not protected by the Torah, and they were led to all sorts of averos of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim. Those were the averos. But the question is, why didn't their Torah protect them? Because they were Mavazes HaTorah. And the lesson for us is very, very simple, that it's not enough in life to do the mitzvos, to go through the motions, but to regard those mitzvos as a burden, as a masa, as something we'd rather not be doing, but we go through it. Because if one is mavaza those mitzvos, if one does not regard them as something special, as something beautiful, as something unique, then the kedusha that those mitzvos generate is going to be defective and incomplete and is going to pull a person down like the garments that didn't give David HaMelech any warmth. And that is really perhaps a little secret that at least among us we have to be willing and have the courage to articulate. And that is, we do have to recognize that sometimes our Yiddishkeit may be like a tree that has beautiful leaves and beautiful branches, but the tree might be dead inside. You know, when a tree stops having sap coming up, a tree can be dead on the inside, and there's no visible evidence of it until sometimes many months later. And the Bali Musar talk about the fact that many of us might be living like that tree, where inside there's no yanika, there's no nourishment, there's no hischadshus, there's no renewal, there's no hislavas, there's no enthusiasm. And unless we connect ourselves to a source of that growth, then eventually the tree's death is going to spread from the inside to the outside. Rav Hirsch remarked regarding 19th century Orthodox Judaism that perhaps we are the opposite of the Maranos. If the Maranos were Jewish on the inside and Goyim on the outside, and we, Baruch Hashem, are able to practice our Yiddishkeit on the outside, but what is it on our inside? What is it that excites us? What is it that gives us a geschmack? Is the Super Bowl or the Olympics more exciting to us than opening up a Gemara or going to a shir or saying Tehillim or doing an act of chesed? And this also is nichlal, that if one is mevazeh es haTorah, if one does not regard Torah and mitzvos as something pleasurable and deep, then the Torah and the mitzvos are not going to do the job. And that is nichlal in lo berchu b'Torah techila. Let me just end with two thoughts. One thought is a light thought, and one thought is a little bit heavier. The light thought is a maisa I once read about a boy in Cheder was once learning how to read Hebrew, and when he saw two yuds together in a sitter, he read it as you'd pronounce two yuds, and the Rebbe says, no, the two yuds are the name of Hashem. You have to pronounce it as Hashem's name. So then he came, at the end of the sitter to a colon, the period, which is one dot on top of another dot that also looks like two yuds. So the student again read it as Hashem's name. And the Rebbe says, no, in this case, it's a period. You don't go any further. So he asked his Rebbe, how come when the two yuds are next to each other, we read it as Hashem's name? And when it's one on top of the other, it's a period. So the Rebbe told him, it's a good word, it's a kind of a joke, but again, it's an emes thoughts. That is, a yud is a yid, a Jew. When two yuds stand side by side, when they join forces, when there's togetherness, when there is sharing, when there is mutual respect, the Shechina is there. That's where the divine presence exists. When one yid stands on top of another yid, that's a period. The Torah can go no further. The Torah stops there. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not exist when one Jew stands on top of another Jew, only when one Jew stands next to the other Jew, standing together, learning from each other, respecting each other, opening oneself up to what each person has to offer the other person. The second thought I want to share with you is a vort from Rav Tzadok. And Rav Tzadok of Lublin asks a very interesting kasha. We know that the Gemara in Brachos tells us that each of the Avos was mesakein a separate prayer. Avraham was mesakein Shachris, Yitzchak was mesakein Mincha, Yaakov was mesakein Ma'ariv. We also know that according to Halacha, Tfilas Arvis Rishus, the only obligatory prayer was Shachris and Mincha. The davening of Ma'ariv was originally an optional prayer, although because of custom, etc., it then became obligatory. Rav Tzadok raises the question that these two laws appear to be inconsistent. We know that Yaakov Avinu was considered to be, on some level, the greatest of the others. Avraham had a Yishmael and Yitzchak had an Esav. It is only Yaakov Avinu that is Mitaso Shlema, that all of his children were part of Klal Yisrael. He's the Bechir Shebi Avais, the choice of the others. So Bedavka, Yaakov Avinu's prayer, should be the one that's optional, kind of less importance. So Rav Tzadok explains very beautifully, and this is an insight that I think is lost in contemporary society because of electric lights and the like, that the concept of having prayers at various transition points of the day, at sunrise and before sunset, is because each tefillah is supposed to generate within us a separate religious mood. The morning, the sun rising, is a time of hope, expectation, joy. Person wakes up in the morning, a person feels, even if the past days haven't been that good, very often in the morning we feel that things might be different today. And that's why, in fact, even lahalacha, that's why the Gemara says, you don't visit a chola lechatchila in the first 3 hours of the day, because the chola will be doing so well, you're not going to pray for him. And you don't visit him the last 3 hours of the day, because he might be doing not so well that you'll give up any hope. You visit him in the middle. In fact, Rav Heinemann once made a cheshbon. That's why the minimum shiur for Bikur Cholim is something like 2.5 minutes, because the Gemara says you can visit a chola even 100 times a day. So he subtracted the first 3 hours and the last 3 hours and divided the midpoint by 100, and he got a certain cheshbon of what the minimum number of the minimum amount of Bikur Cholim is. But be it as it may, the morning, therefore, is the prayer of Hakaras HaTov, gratitude, appreciation, wonder, for all the goodness that Hashem has given. And that is the tefillah of Avraham Avinu, who, at least after the Akedah, was zocheh to have many years of joy, reconciliation. As you know, he was even reconciled to Yishmael, because after Sarah died, Yishmael did Shuvah. So he was zocheh to have everybody with him. Mincha is a prayer. If you ever see the New York Stock Exchange around 4 o'clock before closing, you see there's a mad rush to get in that last deal. Because once the gong rings, that's it for the night. Imagine an agricultural society without lights. When the sun is setting, that's the end of the day, and there are things that have to be done. So the mood of Mincha is a sense of fear and trepidation as the day is coming to the end and opportunities are slipping away. Rav Tzadok says very beautifully, this was the tefillah of Mincha, of Yitzchak. Yitzchak was still very wealthy, very powerful. Yitzchak had all of those brachas. But Yitzchak also was the beginning of the 400 years of Gullus. Remember, the 400 years of exile begin from the birth of Yitzchak. Yitzchak, if you can take a modern comparison, it seems to be something like the German Jews in the early 1930s. They're still rich, they're still prosperous, they're still there, but there begins to be intimations. Maybe you'd be comfortable being somewhere else, right? Yitzchak digs wells and they fill it up. No petty harassments, but there's this intimation that things are slipping away. And that is the prayer of Mincha, where we ask Hashem, I thank you, Hashem, for all that you've given me. And I ask you to give me the ability to hold on to these brachas. Right? That's why in Mincha, there is the tinge of panic that was perhaps absent from Shacharis. We then come to Yaakov. When was Yaakov Avinu misaking the prayer of Ma'ariv? Vayifka b'makom v'yolin shem. He's running away from his brother Esav. His brother Esav wants to kill him. Yaakov Avinu is 63 years old. He doesn't have a shidduch, right? There is hope even for older bachelors. He doesn't have a shidduch. Has no money. His life is threatened by his brother, who's going to kill him. He thinks his father is going to die, although Lamaisa Yitzchak lived for many years later, but he thinks Yitzchak is going to die. He's leaving the holiness of Eretz Yisrael. He's leaving the Ohel of Torah, which is the only sheltered environment he ever knew. He's going to a Lavan, who, if Lavan will not destroy him physically, Lavan could certainly destroy him spiritually. There was certainly that danger. So in a sense, he's going from the frying pan to the fire. Penniless, homeless, leaving spiritual resources, leaving the Ohel Shel Torah, leaving the Avir of a Yitzchak Avinu. Yaakov has hit rock bottom. It's dark. Now remember, the angels don't appear till after Yaakov prayed for Ma'ariv. Okay? In other words, Yaakov did not yet have the vision of the Malachi Elohim when this happens. And Rav Tzadok says, Ma'ariv represents the prayer where even in darkness, even in despair, even in Churban, a person has the capacity to affirm their emuna in Hashem. And Rav Tzadok points out, the reason Ma'ariv is an optional prayer is not because it's less important, but because it represents the highest madrega. Everybody, even the basic human being, it can be expected to be makir tov for the obvious goodness in their life. What does the Navi Yeshayahu say? We read it yesterday. Yada shor koneyu. Even the ox knows who feeds it, who owns it. The chamor evos ba'olav, and the donkey is grateful to the owner that puts food in the trough. So a shachris and a mincha, of course. But the ability to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu even in darkness, even in galus, even in persecution, even when there's no reason to hope, but to affirm that emunah anyway, is a very, very sublime level. That is the level of Yaakov Avinu. And this is what the Mefarshim say, is what David HaMelech alludes to when he says, "Lahagid baboker chastecha v'munascha balelos," in the morning of my life, in the day of my life, when things are good, I can affirm the chesed of Hashem. V'emunascha balelos, and when there's the darkness that envelops me, I have emunah in Hashem anyway. And Ma'ariv is therefore the tefillah of emunah, and emunah is the midah of Yaakov, emes v'emunah. Emes is Yaakov, is linked to emunah, because that's the midah of Yaakov. But you know what the funny thing is? Right after Yaakov prays, Yaakov has the vision of the malachim Elokim olim v'yordim ba. And the truth of the matter is, the malachim were there all along, but Yaakov didn't see them. It's like the lights were off. And that is, the metaphor of galus is that in galus the Shechina is here. Hashem is here. But we don't perceive it. We don't know it. That's why Hester Panim. The Panim is here, but it's Nister. We don't know it. And ironically, through the Yisarusa Nilatatas, through our own Hisorus, through our own recognition and desire to be close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, through our affirmation of emunah that even in the darkness we see the light, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that light becomes visible. So in a sense, we have two contradictory avodas. One is to recognize that we are in darkness, that if we have the illusion of being in the light, we remain in a state of blindness. But number two, ironically, by realizing that we're dark, we cause the lights to go on. And we ask Hashem, let me see, not only, in other words, if I'm in the darkness, not only take me out of the darkness, but let me see the light that is even within the darkness. And the emes is, this is a machshava that is relevant not only for the national calamity of Tisha B'Av, but for the difficulties that every human being goes through, because the truth of the matter is, everything that goes on in our lives, our own sufferings, our alienation, our loneliness, our illness, our machlokas, our lack of shalom bayis, the difficulties we may have with parents and with our children, all of this is just a microcosm of the Hester Panim that exists in the world. And if we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, show me the light within my darkness. Show me how all of the adversities that I have can perfect me, can elevate me, can bring me closer to you. Then, as is true for Yaakov Avinu, we too will be zocha to see that or mitocha choshech. So that is what I want to leave you with, that what we need above all is to know that we're in the dark, and through that process, maybe be zocha to see the light that is in that darkness. I wish all of us a happy Tisha B'Av, but again, as Rav Weiss said, and as I indicated, precisely in this Hakara, there is the seeds of joy, because knowing that we're in the darkness is the very first step to turning on the light switch, and may all of us be zocha to do so. B'mehirah v'yameinu. Thank you.